sponsor?
You know, you can't talk about the Garden Burger without talking about its creator, Paul Wynn. Back in 1986, Wynn owned a small restaurant in Colorado. He noticed he was throwing out a lot of wonderful food. He thought, I wonder if I could process this food in such a way that I could make something delicious and healthy. Well, the answer is yes, and the name of that product is the Garden Burger. Today, we're going to explore the Garden Burger, talk about recipes, exciting things you can do with the Garden Burger, your families and friends. Another one of the infomercials I did for Garden Burger.
Yes,
is that a big failure? Let's sell a Garden Burger on an infomercial.
My brother still eats that.
Does he really?
Stuff.
Stuff? You can't talk about the Garden Burger without talking about its creator, Paul Wynner.
That's right.
All right.
Or cardboard.
I could sell Neat Feet instead. Want to get Hannah Scott in here?
Yes.
Reason he paused. Cough. He was not thinking about whether or not to have you on. Of course you're coming on.
Yeah.
You're following latest legislation, this one regarding the death penalty.
Yeah. So remember back in October, the state Supreme Court ruled that our death penalty in our state was unconstitutional as applied because they found that it was applied arbitrarily and with racial bias. At that time, the governor and state attorney general both called on lawmakers to close the gap left by the court because the court decision left open the slight possibility for the legislature to make a fix so that it could still be used. But the governor and state attorney general said, nope, let's go legislature, make it so it's completely abolished. That proposal came from Reuven Carlisle and was up in a Senate committee yesterday.
It's been a long public discourse the last 10 or 15 years in our state and in our country about this issue. The result of that civic discourse in the last number of years has been a growing recognition that the data shows that the death penalty is applied in a way that is not consistent and that has serious gaps on every level.
Now, Dick Morgan, who's a former Secretary of Corrections for our state, came and spoke on behalf of nearly a half dozen of the former Secretaries of Corrections here in support of abolishing the death penalty. He says, among other things, it's very difficult on personnel.
It takes over 100 personnel to carry out an execution. Several employees have said no thanks after having participated in an execution. When we talk about the high cost of the death penalty, that isn't calculated in.
You know, one of the other things that got brought up here by Senator Mike Patton was a separate bill on the death penalty. This one was from Senator Wagner that would have allowed for the death penalty in cases where a life without parole inmate kills someone else while they're still behind bars, because effectively there's no punishment for that, which was the case with Jamie Bindle, the corrections officer there. That got brought up. That bill is not expected to get a hearing, but Dick Morgan, the former corrections secretary, was asked his thoughts.
I can certainly understand the sentiment of, particularly when you're talking about Officer Bindle being murdered by someone who was already doing life in prison work. Any inmate can act out and you can wind up being murdered by that person. It's a thought that never leaves those that work in prisons. But the threat of a death penalty doesn't change that.
And he said they do have other punishments like solitary confinement where they can put, you know, use them in cases like that. In the end, this was, I've covered the efforts to abolish the death penalty in the state for several years. Usually these are packed hearings. There was only, I don't know, a handful of people all on the pro side there yesterday to speak in support of this. The alternative bill, like I said, is not expected to get a hearing. This will be voted in committee tomorrow, and I would expect that this will move.
So for something this controversial, it sounds like, do you think it's going to be a slam dunk?
I would be surprised if it's not.
Wow.
Yeah. So
right now, there are 8 people in death row. There's 3 black, 5 white.
Yes,
right?
That's okay. Correct. Yeah. Yes. And remember, the state Supreme Court decision was based on that University of Washington study with found one or African-Americans are 4 times more likely to end up on death row in our state.
Why is that?
That was the numbers that they looked at. But
I know, why? Did they say, is it because they don't get good representation in court? Is it because the crimes are more grievous? Is it because the jury is a different color than the defendant? Is it, what are the additional factors? Do we just assume racism, or do we assume that there's a breakdown in the system along the way? I heard that it's disproportionate, but why is it disproportionate?
And I do not have the answer to that. What I can tell you is there are several lawmakers who find flaws with that study and don't support it, including Senator Wagner, who had the alternative bill.
Okay.
So I'm surprised there's not at least a pocket of Republicans, conservatives in Olympia that aren't gathering support to fight it. Because this is one of those, I mean, I know we are more blue than a red state, but we are kind of purplish in terms of the makeup of the state legislature. It's right now, it's barely tipped a Democratic, but it's been the other way.
Heavier. They have enough to beat the majority.
Yes. You know. I'm just surprised that there isn't sort of an active, just because this is one of those hot button issues.
I was too. I was. Okay. I'll be honest with you. I really was. I can tell you, there was, you know, Senator Mike Patton brought up the Jimmy Bindle bill yesterday and then he also asked if this is symbolic. So here's the deal. The court decision, that's what they discussed yesterday, also essentially made it nearly impossible to do anything further. So it's kind of a done deal. I think that's why you don't see as much fight. Even Jamie Bindle's family, I spoke with them. They fought every year against the abolish bills. Yeah. They won't come down for these anymore because they think it's a done deal.
Last bit of information, executions by skin color from 1904 to 2010, 66 white, 7 black, 2 Asian, 2 Hispanic, 1 Eskimo.
Yeah. Like I said, a lot of disagreement on that particular point.
Got it.
That's why we have a Supreme Court.
Thank you, Hannah Scott.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. The Pope acknowledges that nuns were also sexually abused by priests and bishops as well. Imagine that. They weren't just going after young boys. Yeah. They're going after the nuns.
This is, and young girls, too.
That's true.
This really comes as something of a shock because it has not gotten nearly the press that the child abuse, the sexual abuse by priests of children has gotten. But apparently, now that I've read the entire long article, there have been official complaints about this since the 1990s. That there were a bunch of nuns who are abused by women. In fact, there was one convent that was shut down because the Pope decided that this happened under Pope Benedict, mm-hmm. so the previous Pope, that they basically, it was a convent of sexual slaves, that the nuns that were serving there were all being abused by priests. They were getting pregnant, and get this, they then were forced to have abortions. So, I mean, you're doing this double. If you're a Catholic and believe in the sanctity of life, you are, raping these women and then forcing them to have abortions. If the children are born, the priests refuse to acknowledge they have anything to do with it. I mean, it's really outrageous, and it's happening in countries all around the world. It's happening in Europe and Africa and Asia and South America. I mean, it really is scandalous. And the only reason it's getting any press now is because for the first time, the Pope has addressed it. He was specifically asked a question on his papal plane, and he addressed it. He says, yes, it's true. There are priests and bishops who have done that, and so now they're resuscitating all the accusations.
The Catholic Church should just pull the Band-Aid off or do some sunshining on this one and just come right out with everything. Stop letting them come drink some drabs. The Pope was asked a number of months ago about a cardinal that apparently he had moved back into sort of the working order. He had taken him out earlier, and then apparently the Pope let him go back, and he knew that he had the sins sort of his previous work, and he put him back into the cycle, and then he sort of was able to sidestep that. The media loves this Pope because he's sort of slightly socialist, so they didn't really put his feet to the fire that strongly. But in this case, the Pope should lead the way for the Catholic Church to say, okay, here are all the sins going back the last 100 years. Now, let's start writing some checks, clear it all up, and move on.
Yeah, and they have done this. Another instance, priests, 30 sisters in one congregation in Malawi were impregnated by priests, and when they complained, they were replaced.
Yeah.
Not the priests, but the nuns.
And you want to hear from a nun?
Okay, yes.
I wanted him to say,
talk about the Pope.
You know, this is absolutely abominable. And I want to assure you that I am taking action, not in the future, but I'm going to begin today. Wherever there's a credible indication of a priest having abused a nun, I am going to have them leave.
There you go. That's a leader.
He could ask his bishops to give him the names, or any case where a nun has come forward. He could examine that in depth immediately. We need to hear, it won't go on. I'm going to have zero tolerance, expel bishops and priests who have credible accusations against them.
Yeah, he's too busy fighting climate change and income inequality.
Sean, I don't know why you're so sour on this.
I'm just sour on that guy, Tom.
In this particular case, within the church, he's seen as a little too radical on this, that he is actually going after this, and you know, thank God that he is. I don't think that the fact that he
most
doesn't
of the
fit
people,
your right-wing politics doesn't mean that he's not doing his due diligence on this.
Did you see his response to the cardinal that was put back in place? Did you see his response?
It was lukewarm.
Yeah, okay, fine. And it's lukewarm on this one.
Well, he apologized. You know, he went to, I forget now which South American country. I apologize. Yeah. I can't remember now if it was Brazil or Argentina. No, he's from Argentina. But anyway, and there was a big scandal there, and he poo-pooed it like it was no big deal.
Yep.
And later, when he got back to the Vatican, I think that people sort of explained to him, this is a big deal, and you mishandled that, and he then apologized. By the way, this is a sign of our times. Because of the work of one particular former nun with the Survivors Network abuse, the hashtag nuns2 is trending on Twitter.
Bloomberg editor Michael Doran explains that Jeff Bezos is doing really well during the Trump administration.
Yeah, it sort of shows you that the president can huff and puff all he wants, but he's not going to hurt a solidly constructed business that's riding a wave of electronic commerce, digital advertising, and cloud computing. Bezos's business has been robust. All the things Trump has threatened, antitrust suits, raising postal rates, other attacks on Amazon, hasn't really materialized. And so Bezos has become the world's richest person while Trump is in the White House. And in fact, he's made $66 billion since Donald Trump's election. So he's made more off the Trump era than anyone else, even the president.
Yeah, he didn't make it off the Trump era. He made it by...
During the Trump era.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But not only that, he made so much money. There are only four men in the world that whose fortunes exceed $64 million, and he made that much in addition to what he had when he started
off. He must be doing something right.
It's incredible.
He must be doing something right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Despite...
Show me a billionaire, and I'll show you a billion happy people.
Oh, golly, getting into that, I'm going to go
get my papers. Just show me a billionaire, and I'll show you happy people. Because if you give people something, they'll pay for it.
You know who's happy? His wife.
Yo. That will be by the biggest payout, right? That will be the biggest payout.
And even so, the amount of profit that he's made in 2 years with Trump will...
Not with Trump. You don't need to put those two together.
Well, no, that's the whole point of this article, that he is the bane of Trump's existence. Trump goes after him all the time, and yet nobody's profited more. All the profits, the money that he'll have to split his fortune with, that money that he goes to his wife, well, he just made up in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
With President Trump.
Trump should do this. He should just lay off Twitter for 1 month. And here's why.
Here's why he should do it. The world would stop.
Absolutely. Stop feeding the machine. If you just didn't give the air to the media would then be forced to find some other stuff to talk about. Like maybe they might talk more about abortion. Maybe they might talk more about the governor in Virginia and then the lieutenant governor and now the AG in Virginia. They
you
might
can't
have more
talk
stuff.
Any
his
more
problem
about that.
Is his problem is he gets in and he throws the stuff out there and then they spend 24 or 32 hours or 36 hours talking about the nonsense he's tweeting on. Just as an experiment, 1 month I'll lay off and then find out what the media is forced to focus on. Will we focus on Elizabeth Warren? Because every time something big starts to roll out on the left and the crazy stuff they're pushing, he tweets something and then you come back to Trump. That's it for 1 month, and let's see what happens in the media.
The thing is, I think those tweets have saved him. Usually they say those tweets are there to distract us from attention when the Mueller investigation is getting a little too hot or when that big 40-page investigation of his bogus finances in the New York Times, it made one splash in one afternoon, and then it was replaced by a tweet. So I think the tweets have actually worked in his favor to distract us.
I think it distracts the media, and then they follow that stuff all over the place. See what happened if he got rid of it for 1 month. A Colorado jogger strangles a mountain lion after an attack on a trail. So the guy's running, and it causes the young juvenile cougar to sort of respond in the fight or flight, thinks this is prey. Apparently the jogger did everything he's supposed to do. He turned around and made noise and made himself bigger than he is. But yeah, yet that was just enough for the cougar to go, you know what? You look like a meal.
This is an amazing strategy. Yeah, they said that the cougar jumps from behind and attacks him as he's running through the foothills, they say, in Horsetooth Mountain. And he turns on them. They said they wrestled for a while, and then he strangled it to death. The one qualifier in this, which I think it is just an amazing story, is that they do call him a juvenile mountain lion, and they say they don't really know how big it was because other animals had then kind of attacked it after it was killed, and so they can't get a good size of it. The smaller it is, the less impressive this feat, but still, it's a pretty, I was going to say
80
lucky,
pounds,
but it's not
Tom.
Lucky. Well, see, that's not what this story is. Reuters doesn't say the size, but 80 pounds is what you've read?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's about time the cougar got an opportunity to go for the belt like that, to go for a chance to be a champion. How many more people does that cougar have to eat until it can get a shot at the title?
Well, unfortunately, though, the danger of this is we are probably moving into the foothills.
Yeah.
100 years ago, I suspected joggers weren't running through. Oh, there he is.
I asked you
this may be the mama. I didn't realize we were there.
Wait, turn on the sound.
It doesn't sound like strangling.
Doesn't see, he's punching and strangling.
Yes, that's a,
well, how do you get the sound of strangling? There you go. There's the story. Oh, it's amazing. Isn't that amazing if someone would be able to? I guess, listen, if your life's in jeopardy like that, you do whatever you can. Apparently, you're supposed to poke him in the eye. Or punch them in the nose, the two soft spots there. But that thing's really leaning on top of you. What?
Mountain lions have caused fewer than 20 deaths in the United States in the past 100 years.
Uh-huh.
So only, you know, fewer than 20 in 100 years. This is a rarity.
All right, let's see. Fast, profitable break. And then, oh, look who's coming by. Rachel Bell. Not that we doubted her, but we did. And we ran out to make sure she was there. How to complain at a restaurant. Now, Rachel knows a lot about this because she loves to eat food. And she loves to talk about food, so there is a proper way to complain and not complain. I've always said that, listen, you do not want to upset the waiter, you don't want to upset the chef.
So you'll eat anything?
I'll eat anything.
Wow.
I've seen stuff come back. Okay, I'll tell you the story of the steak.
Oh, you mean when you worked at a restaurant? Okay.
No. But that guy did, complaining about the steak. We'll come right back. Rachel's got that. Plus, also, we'll talk about consent to be born. So a guy, he's 27 years old, and he's suing his parents because he was born without his permission. Should have gone to New York State. We'll be right back. All righty. Anybody want to pay for any of this stuff?
The text line, maybe.
Oh, yeah, sure. Online Trade Academy text line 98973. We are in the business of business now.
You are. And we haven't lost them.
No, we haven't. Online Trading Academy. They practically own this station.
Yeah.
Surprised they haven't renamed the entire station. We drive up here, park the car. We're going into the Online Trading Academy building. All right. Let's see. By the way, are they going to name Colleen O'Brien's baby?
Online Trading OT.
How are you? What's wrong? You're looking at me like that. That's the look that normally.
That's the look of the girl who wants to name another woman's baby. Because I don't want to have children, but I want to name a baby. Because isn't that fun? You got to name children. Why shouldn't I get to name a baby?
I'm sure somebody
find a woman who's
that.
Willing to bear one.
Who? Oh, well, that's okay, what I'm saying. Colleen O'Brien, maybe, like, I get to name her baby.
That would be nice.
I think it'd be nice, too.
Well, listen, if this guy has his way, you won't have any babies to ever have to name, because apparently just being born is unfair to the person being born, and the minute you are born, you begin dying and experiencing pain, so life isn't so great. So this guy comes along and says, you know what? I'm going to take my parents to court.
I love this story.
Really?
This is a story about a 27-year-old guy from India. His name's Raphael Samuel, and he is preparing to sue his parents, allegedly, for the mere act of giving birth to him. He says he didn't want to be born. This wasn't about him. His parents chose to have him for their own joy. And now he's stuck here on this earth and he didn't want to be here. But weirdly, he says in an interview that he did, he says, quote, "I love my parents and we have a great relationship, but they had me for their joy and pleasure. My life has been amazing, but I don't see why I should put another life," this is him talking about why he doesn't want to have children, "through the rigmarole of school and finding a career, especially when they didn't ask to exist." Now, here's the twist that I loved. His parents are both lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So his mom actually has responded to this and she's like, "I think that this is very interesting, but like, we're lawyers. I'm really looking forward to him suing us. Like, what is he talking about?" But she doesn't really seem to have a problem with this, at least that she's been talking about on social media. She says, "I'm very happy my son has grown up into a fearless, independent thinking young man." So he runs this group called Child Free India. And I had to look up this word. It's called
Anti-niacin. Is it the opposite?
No, I can't. Oh, natalist.
Natalist,
he's an
right.
Anti-natalist, which means anti-birth, which is fine. Like, don't have your own children. But I actually think this is fascinating because on the surface, you can easily just say, oh, this guy's nuts.
Yeah.
But it only took me like 20 more seconds to get very existential and realize that he's kind of right.
Well, when are his rights afforded to him? At the time of his birth?
Well, I don't think he's right to sue them.
I know, but I'm just saying, how would you make this legal argument?
Yes.
The rights afforded to you as a citizen to sue occur.
Wow. Ursula's angry
as
today.
A mother
she's pounding on the counter. I love my children.
You have the rights afforded to you at the time of your birth.
Yes.
And now you're going to sue because of your birth.
Yes.
Yes.
I think that part's dumb, but I do agree with like thinking about existentially the fact that your parents did bring you into this world for their own reasons. And then what are your responsibilities? Like, we all have to follow society's rules or else we become shunned. You either become homeless or very poor or very unhappy or all three of those things. So I guess that's why we all follow along and have jobs and stuff. But what happens when you... It's confusing because he says he's a happy person. He likes his parents, but he also wishes he wasn't born. It sounds like he's just trying to prove a point.
Yes. A couple of things, though. Would he approve them? I don't know what religion or if he has any belief system in India that would mitigate this, but would he prefer abortions? Because a lot of times people give birth and are not planning on it.
Yeah.
And maybe even, you know, would rather not, but they feel like they, you know, once a child is created in the womb that they should carry forth, does he approve of abortions, say? If you find out you're pregnant, would he approve of abortions?
It seems like he might. Seems like a real liberal guy.
And what,
I mean, maybe if you live in India, you might be more apt to be anti-birth because you live in a really crowded place.
If he is complaining about the pain and they talk about that the minute you are born, you begin decaying and dying and life is nothing but a series of misery and hardship, then why doesn't he end his life now?
That's right.
Right.
I mean, he could take it out on himself.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is he asking for damages? So what happens? Let's say he wins in court.
He won't
win. You selfish people. You shouldn't have had me. Then what?
I know. What are you going to win? What money is going to make your life
existentially
better.
More fulfilling?
Yeah, it's confusing because, if you don't want to have children, fine. Don't have what is? I mean, unless his parents, that would be something then to be upset with your parents about. Mm. If you don't want to have children, but they won't stop bugging you about it, then I can understand why they're impeding on your lifestyle.
Yeah,
but
it's a fun sort of, hey, let's pass the joint around and have a conversation.
Yes.
Yes.
Speaking of which, as a tease for my review on Friday, there's a foreign film that's nominated for Academy Award called Capernaum, and it opens with a 12-year-old boy taking his parents in Lebanon to court, suing them. Why? Because his life has been nothing but degradation because he's undocumented. He's living in the streets. And so it takes the same premise. Mm. But see, in a movie, it allows you to examine all sorts of philosophical issues. It doesn't resolve the court issue. It just raises us to have that conversation and passing the joint
around.
Are you
saying movies are better than this radio show?
this radio show is a movie.
That's true, Tom. The fact that when you go into a restaurant and you complain, there's a right way and a wrong way to complain. Since I don't really care about food and Tom can't afford it, we thought we'd bring Rachel in to talk about how is the proper way to tell the waiter or the chef that you have a problem with whatever it is you've ordered.
Well, sit down. I have a soliloquy to make here since neither of you are interested or invested in this topic.
You have 2 minutes.
Okay. This is a story that was in the New York Times, and it was written by their critic, Pete Wells, and he said, how to complain at a restaurant? Just ask our critic because his job is criticism. So now anyone can be a critic because of Yelp. And then there's food blogs. And now even on social media, I'll see people just like ripping restaurants to shreds. Mm-hmm. And so what he's talking about is, what do you want when you complain? Because if you go on Yelp and you don't say anything when you're in the restaurant, you're not going to get anything changed. If you ordered a steak that was supposed to be medium rare and it comes out well done and you leave the restaurant quiet and then you complain about it elsewhere, your problem was never solved. So right. The idea is just, what do you want? What is the result? And most people are too afraid to say anything at the table. But then they get this courage to be super mean online and, you know, try to shut down a restaurant that you could have just fixed the problem. There's nothing really inherently wrong with what's
So how does he say you should do it? He's a critic. What does he do? If he gets something that isn't cooked properly, what does he do? Does he not write about it nastily in the paper?
I don't know what he does about that. I personally, I'll send things back if it's not cooked right. But I hate doing it. It makes me, and yeah. I always do this whole stupid, like, I'm so sorry. I don't normally do this. I'm like, you like me, right? I'm likable. I'm really likable. Just give me a better piece of meat. But some of these restaurateurs in New York added to the article saying that they want the feedback because if they put something new on the menu, they won't know what people think about it if nobody says anything. So they'll take it off if they get enough complaints.
I see.
I saw a guy when I worked at L'Auberge in Stratford, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. It was a fancy French restaurant. He didn't like the steak. He said that it wasn't well done enough. I took it back. I said to the chef, who's a big angry German guy, he says he wants it more well done. The chef, who hates doing well done, they hate well done. He puts it on the thing, holds it there for a moment, turns around, says, now here, serve it. I clean off the dish. I take it back. I give it to the guy. He opens it back up again and says, no. More well done. I take it back. Third time in, the chef says, he wasn't well done. I do well done. And he takes it. He takes the steak. He throws it on the big rubber mat behind where he's working, his station. He takes his big, gross, disgusting, oily, greasy, black clog and steps on the piece of meat and pushes it down through the rubber mat. And then he picks it up, throws it onto the top of the burner and holds the spatula down on top of it and burns one side of it. Burns all the hair and gunk and everything else off that was stuck on it from the rubber mat. And then he turns and goes, now serve it.
It's like,
and it
wow.
turns out that customer was David Hasselhoff.
And he loved it.
And that German chef was sorry then.
Because the Germans love David Hasselhoff.
You put it together.
I think the lesson is that you shouldn't have a German cook in a French restaurant.
Let me tell you, those guys, any one of those guys.
That's cultural appropriation.
Yeah, well, he knew what he was doing, and he might have spent time studying in France as well. I remember the night he said he wanted a raise. It was like 8 o'clock at night on a Saturday, and the owner had to go down there and beg him, like literally grab his leg and stop him from leaving. I mean, they knew. Those guys know they've got you. They got you by the short hairs.
What? Why are you looking at me?
Why are you looking at me? I thought you were going to say something clever.
I was trying to think of something.
That was.
A power out, as we call it.
Why don't you do this? Think of something and then come back in the next segment and just yell it out.
Okay, without any reference?
Yeah, no reference.
Perfect.
Let's start the next segment. You come up with a power.
Oh, okay. What time?
All right. 47.
I'll be ready.
All right, right back. Tom and Curly Show. We'll talk about how historians are. Oh no. Tom's going to sing show tune.
Not really. It's rap.
No.
And then Mary said, who ate all the chimichangas? Oh, God. Isn't that rich?
Here we go. Welcome back, everybody. Let's see. There is some debate going on regarding the great Broadway show Hamilton. Both Tom and I saw it, raved about it at the Paramount Theater, and I feel guilty every time the Paramount says, hey, why don't you do a story on the new show we have? We did give you tickets to Hamilton.
I know, but at least in your defense, you defended it, whereas Dory took the free tickets and then trashed it.
Did he? Yeah, he made fun of it the whole time.
No,
listen, I love the energy of it. I thought it was an interesting take. I don't know if it's necessarily rap, but now there's some new sort of hits going after. Historians have a problem. Imagine this. Someone has taken liberties with facts.
Yes. However, the great thing about this is most of us who'd done any kind of a founding father's history, and all of us had a chance to look at it, Alexander Hamilton was one of the more boring characters. He was a guy who starred the Treasury. He was significant, but he didn't do dramatic kinds of things. He was more of a sort of behind the scenes.
Well, he hated
kind
Adams.
Of guy.
I mean, hated Burr.
Yeah, that's right. The only thing we knew about him, except, you know, was the duel, and he got, you know, killed in this duel. So there's this great biography out about Hamilton, and then what Lin-Manuel Miranda did was take parts of the biography and kind of transformed that's our image of Hamilton and showed what a great guy he was. Now there have been historians. Now it's finally coming to a head because another playwright has written a counter to Hamilton, a black writer, Ishmael Reed. I've interviewed him in the past. He's this great kind of postmodernist writer, and he is taking Lin-Manuel to task. In the form of a kind of, it's a play that he's that he just did a stage reading of, about putting Lin-Manuel Miranda sort of on trial, kind of like a Christmas Carol. He has people coming from Hamilton's past to berate him,
that's the
whole setup. And what their biggest gripe is that by turning Hamilton into a hero, you whitewash certain things about him. The play is best known for being, you know, sort of multiracial, you know, that you can have a black Aaron Burr and a Hispanic Hamilton, and George Washington can be of a completely different race. And it's all sort of that kind of all-embracive approach to race and ethnicity. And yet they whitewash the fact that he was himself a slave owner.
Right. Like, just about everybody.
Right. And they don't really do anything like that. And they say, for instance, and this is suggested by the play, he bought two slaves for $250. Uh-huh. Can you imagine how different the tenor of Hamilton would be if they did a song called $250? And it's all about how he was buying slaves. He says it's not a fair representation of who Hamilton was. And the fact that because it's a pro-immigrant thing, remember there's this famous line where we immigrants get things done. Everybody cheers because of
hear
it.
That?
Monsieur Hamilton.
No, that's not it. Is this one right here? Which one is it?
That's the first one.
Hang on. Here you go, Tom. You'll like this.
Okay. Monsieur Hamilton.
Monsieur Lafayette.
In command where you belong.
Are you saying no sweater? We're finally on the field. We've had quite a run.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
Yeah, yes. And everybody cheers. That's adorated.
It is. It's great.
Direct shot at Trump, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And Trump's a racist.
The thing is, it wasn't a direct shot at Trump. It now has become a direct shot at Trump because he's such a jerk. Uh-huh. But it was written before that. Remember, it was written during the Obama administration, and it was an idea to kind of raise up the idea of what Obama represents as a president. However, they say that he really
was...
It's an
applause line now. You can see the way it's directed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They say he really was more of an anti-immigrant elitist. Now, he was an immigrant himself, and that's the root of Lin-Manuel Miranda and Ron Chernow's biography.
Right.
But they said as he came to power, he apparently, and I don't know, I'm not a historian, so I don't know this, but they say the critique is that he himself was kind of anti-immigrant.
Yes.
So to present him as this kind of all-encompassing, we immigrants, we get things done, might be unfair. And a misrepresentation of Hamilton.
The story of Hamilton is being written from the perspective of Hamilton at that time. And at that time, you could own a slave. So he is, but this guy's looking back and saying, oh, but from now, judging here, right?
Yes.
And there's a great piece I was reading from Jefferson saying, listen, here's the deal. We can get blacks and include them as citizens, but we will not get this Constitution. We will not have the Constitution if we do that. Would you be better off with the Constitution and fix it later? Which is what they did.
And I'm not throwing away my shot.